and being promoted, at least to major, for his valor in capturing them, his lot would be to die in a sleet storm on the frozen plain. He thought of shooting himself, but his hands were so cold he feared he would merely drop his pistol if he tried to pull it out. The pistol, too, was coated in bloody ice. It might not even shoot. Then Gus saw the light again and yelled out, hoping somebody ahead would hear him. "There's the light! There it is! We're close!" he said. This time Bigfoot saw it, too. "By God, he's right," he said. "We're coming to some place with a fire." Then he heard something that sounded like the bleating of sheep. The men who heard it all perked up. If there were sheep, they might not starve. Captain Salazar suddenly felt better. "I remember the stories," he said. "There is a spring, an underground river. They raise sheep here. This must be San Saba. I thought it was just a lie, a traveler's lie about the sheep and the spring. Most travelers lie, and few sheep cross this desert, but maybe it is true." One by one, hopeful for the first time in days, the men plodded on toward the light. Now and then they lost it in the sleet, and their hopes sank, but Gus McCrae had taken a bead on the light, and leaving Matilda to support Woodrow Call, led the troop into the little village of San Saba. There were not many adobe huts, but there were many, many sheep. The ones they heard bleating were in a little rail corral behind the jefe's hut, and the jefe himself, an old man with a large belly, was helping a young ewe bring forth her first kid. The light they had seen was his light. At first he was surprised and alarmed by the spectral appearance of the Texans, all of them white with the sleet that covered their clothes. The old man had no weapon. He could do nothing but stare. Also, the ewe was at her crisis, and he could not afford to worry about the men who appeared out of the night until he had delivered the kid. Although he had many sheep, he also lost many to the cold, to wolves, and coyotes, and cougars. He wanted to see that the kid was correctly delivered before he had to face the wild men who had come in on a stormy night into the village. He thought they might be ghosts. If they were ghosts, perhaps the wind would blow them on, out of the village, leaving him to attend his flock. Captain Salazar, cheered by the knowledge that his troop was saved, became a captain again, and soon had reassured the jefe that they were not ghosts, but a detachment of the Mexican army on an important mission involving dangerous captives. He was not hard to convince the jefe that the Texans were dangerous men. They looked as wild as Apaches to the old man. Once the kid was delivered, the jefe immediately sprang to work, and soon had the whole village up, building fires and preparing food for the starving men. Several sheep were slaughtered, while the women set about making coffee and tortillas. Because it was Gus who had seen the light and saved the troop, Captain Salazar decreed that the Texans would not be bound. He was aware that he himself would have missed the light, and probably the village, in which case all his men would have died. There would have been no medals and no promotion. The Texans were put in a shed where the sheep were sheared, with a couple of good fires to warm them. Gus, sitting with Call, soon got to hear the very sound he'd dreamt of, the sound of fat sizzling as it dripped into a fire. Some of the men were too tired even to wait for food. They took a little hot coffee, grew drowsy, and tipped over. The floor of the shed was covered with a coat of sheep's wool, mixed with dirt. The wool made some of the men sneeze, but that was a minor irritation. "I guess we lost Long Bill," Bigfoot said.
"If we lost him, we lost Johnny, too," Gus said. "He should have waited until we found his town. Maybe one of the Mexicans would have gone back with us and we could have found Johnny."
Matilda was silent by the fire. All she could think about was that Shadrach was dead. He had wanted to take her west, to California. He had promised her, but now that prospect was lost. Long after most of the Texans had eaten a good hunk of mutton and gone to sleep, there was a shout from the Mexicans. Long Bill Coleman, his clothes a suit of ice, came walking slowly into the circle of fires, carrying Johnny Carthage in his arms. Johnny, too, seemed to be sheathed in ice. At first no one could say whether Johnny Carthage was alive or dead. He laid his friend down by the warmest campfire and himself stood practically in the flames, shaking and trembling from cold and from exertion. He held out his hands to the fire. He was so close that ice began to melt off his clothes.
"If that's mutton, I'll have some," he said. "I swear it's been a cold walk."
For 3 days, the Texans, under guard again, never left their sheepshed, except to answer calls of nature. Captain Salazar's escort had been reduced by more than 20 men, lost and presumed frozen back along the sleety trail. 6 Texans failed to make the village. The weather stayed so cold that most of the men were glad of the confinement. They were allowed ample firewood and plenty to eat. Blackie Slidell had to have 2 frostbitten toes removed. Bigfoot Wallace performed the operation with a sharp bowie knife, but no one else required amputations. Once the people of the village realized that the Texans were not specters, they were friendly. The old jefe, still much occupied with his lambing in the terrible weather, saw that they had ample food. The men could drink coffee all day. Poor coffee, but warming. Noticing that Carl was injured, one old woman asked to look at his back. When she saw the blackened scab, she drew in her breath and hurried away. A few minutes later, the woman returned, another woman at her side. The other woman was so short she scarcely came to Bigfoot's waist. She had with her a little pot. She went quickly to Carl, but instead of lifting his shirt as the first woman had, she put her thin face close to his back and sniffed.
"Hell, she's smelling you," Bigfoot said. "I wonder if you smell like venison."
Bigfoot's remarks were sometimes so foolish that Carl was irritated by them. Why would he smell like venison? And why was the wizened little Mexican woman smelling him anyway? He was passive, though. He didn't answer Bigfoot, and he didn't move away from the woman. The village women had been unexpectedly kind. The food they brought was warm and tasty. One woman had even given him an old serape to cover himself with. It had holes in it, but it was thickly woven and kept out the chill. He thought perhaps the tiny woman who was sniffing him was some kind of healer. He knew he was in no position to reject help. He was still very weak, often feverish, and always in pain. He could survive while in the warmth of the sheep shed, but if he were forced to march and was caught in another sleet storm, he might not live. He could not ask Gus or Matilda to carry him again as they had the first time. The little woman sniffed him thoroughly as a dog might, and then set her pot in the edge of the nearest campfire. She squatted by it, muttering words no one could understand. When she judged the medicine to be ready, she gestured for Carl to remove his shirt. She then spent more than 2 hours rubbing the hot ointment into his back. She carefully kneaded his muscles and spread the ointment gently along the line of every scar. At first the ointment burned so badly that Carl thought he would not be able to stand the pain. The burning was far worse than what he could remember of the whipping itself. For several minutes Gus and Matilda had to talk to him in an effort to distract him from the burning. At one point they thought they might have to restrain him, but Carl gritted his teeth and let the little woman do her work. In time, a warmth spread through his body, and he slept soundlessly, without moaning, for the first time since the whipping. The next day, through a crack in the wall, Gus saw the same woman applying ointment to Captain Salazar's neck. The captain looked weak. He had taken a fever which soared so high that he was sometimes incoherent. The jefe took him into his house and the little woman tended him until the fever dropped. Even so, the captain was at first too weak to walk in a straight line. He wanted to stay and rest in San Saba, but when the weather warmed a little, he decided he had better take advantage of it and press on. He came to the Texan's shed to inform them of his decision.
"Enjoy a warm night," he told them. "We leave tomorrow."
"How many days before we get across this dead man's walk?"
Long Bill asked.
"Señor, we have not yet come to the Jornada," Salazar said. "The land here is fertile because of the underground water. Once we get beyond where the sheep are, we will start the dead man's walk."
The Texans were silent. They'd all convinced themselves that the day of the sleet would be their worst day. They had forgotten that Salazar said the dead man's walk was 200 miles across. They had grown used to the coziness of the shed and the warmth of the campfires. Each of them could remember the bitter cold, the pain of marching on frozen feet, the sleet, and the hopeless sense that they would die if they didn't find warmth. They had found warmth, but Salazar had just reminded them that the hardest part of the journey had not even begun. Some of the men hunched closer to the campfires, holding out their hands to the warmth. They wanted to hug the warmth, keep it as long as they could. Few of them slept. They wanted to sit close to the fires and enjoy every bit of warmth left to them. They wanted the warmth to last forever, or at least until summertime. Johnny Carthage, terrified that he would fall so far behind that Long Bill Coleman couldn't find him and rescue him, asked over and over again through the night how long it would be until morning. Informed by the old jefe that there was neither food nor water enough for many horses in the barren region that awaited them, Salazar kept only one horse, his own, and traded several for two donkeys and as much provender as the donkeys could carry. On the morning of departure, abruptly, he decided to reduce the force to 25 men. He reasoned that 25 could probably hold off the Apaches if they attacked. More than 25 would be impossible to provision on such a long journey. The Texans alone would account for most of the provisions the donkeys could carry. What that meant was that the Texans would slightly outnumber his own force, and the Texans, man for man, were stronger than his troops.
"Señores, you will have to be tied," he informed the Texans when they were led out into the cold air. "I regret it, but it is necessary. I can afford no risks on this journey. Crossing the Dead Man's Walk is risk enough."
Bigfoot swelled up at this news. Gus thought he was going to make a fight, but he held on to his temper and let his wrists be bound with rawhide thongs when his turn came. The other men did the same. Even Call was tied, though Matilda lodged a strong protest.
"This boy's hurt. He can't do nothing. Why tie him?" she asked.
"Because he has fury in him," Captain Salazar said. "I saw it myself. He almost killed Colonel Cobb while he was riding in our general's buggy. If I had to choose only one of you to tie, I would tie Corporal Call."
"I suppose that's a compliment, ain't it?" Gus said.
"I don't care what it is," Call said.
Since the old woman had treated him with her ointment, he could at least stretch his muscles without groaning in pain. He glared at the young Mexican who tied him, although he knew the boy was simply doing his job. Many of the women of San Saba broke into tears when they saw the Texans being tied. Some of them had formed motherly attachments to one prisoner or another. Some pressed additional food, tortillas, or pieces of jerky into the men's hands as they were marched through the street out of the village.
The fertile country lasted only 3 miles. By the 4th mile, only the smallest scrub grew. Soon even that disappeared. Before them, as far ahead as they could see, was a land where nothing grew.
"This is the Dead Man's Walk," Captain Salazar said. "Now we will see who wants to live and who wants to die."
"I intend to live," Gus said at once.
Call said nothing.
"Even the Apaches won't cross it," Salazar said.
One-eyed Johnny Carthage looked at the emptiness before them and was filled with dread.
"What's the matter, Johnny?"
Long Bill said, noting his friend's haggard look.
"It's warmer now and we got food. We'll get across this like we got across the plains."
Johnny Carthage heard what Long Bill said, but didn't believe him. He looked at the great space before them and shivered. Not from cold, but from fear. He felt that he was looking at his death.
Part 3.
On the 4th night out from San Saba, a warm night that left the men encouraged, Captain Salazar's horse and both donkeys disappeared. Some of their provisions were still on the donkeys. They had traveled late and had only unpacked what they needed for the evening meal, corn mostly, with a little dried mutton. Captain Salazar had tethered his horse so close to his pallet that the lead rope was in reach of his hand as he slept. He had only to turn over to reassure himself that his horse was still there. But when he did turn over in the gray dawn, all he had left was the end of the lead rope, which had been cut. The horse was gone.
"I thought you said Indians didn't come here," Bigfoot said, annoyed.
He had wondered at the laxness of the Mexicans in setting no guard. The foot soldiers had simply lain down and slept where they stopped, with no thought of anything but rest. The Texans did the same, but the Texans were tied. Guard duty was not their responsibility. Captain Salazar was silent, shocked by what had happened and what it meant. He stared for a long time across the dry plain, as if hoping to see his horse and the donkeys grazing peacefully. But all he saw was the barren earth, with an edge of sun poking above it to the east. Bigfoot had to repeat his statement.
"I guess those Indians that don't come here took your horse," he said.
"Gomez took my horse," Salazar said. "Gomez is not like the rest. He has no fear of this country. No one else would be so bold."
"That rope he cut was about 3 feet from your throat," Bigfoot remarked. "He could have cut your throat if he'd wanted to."
Captain Salazar was looking at the cut end of the lead rope. A scalpel could not have cut it more cleanly. Bigfoot was right. Gomez could easily have cut his throat.
He could have, but there would have been little sport, he said. We must walk.
By mid-morning, all the men felt the air, which had been warm, turn chill. The north wind picked up.
Oh, God, I don't want it to get cold, Johnny Carthage said. I wouldn't mind to die if I could just do it warm.
The great dread had not left him.
Shut up your complaining. It's just a breeze so far, Long Bill said. I carried you once, and I'll carry you again if it comes to that.
No, you won't, Bill. You can't carry me no 100 miles, Johnny said.
But the wind was already howling at their backs, and no one heard him. Carl walked between Matilda and Gus. He was still unsteady on his feet and was swept at times by waves of fever that made his vision swirl. Matilda was the only one of the Texans who had not been tied. Captain Salazar had come to like her. From time to time she consented to play cards with him. He would not fraternize to that extent with the prisoners, and his own men were mostly too young to be good card players. An old bear hunter had taught him rummy. It was mostly rummy that he played with Matilda Jane.
As they were stumbling along, pushed by the cold north wind, Gus happened to look back, a habit he got into after his encounter with the grizzly bear. He could not get Bigfoot's story about the man who had been stalked while fishing out of his mind. It was worrisome that bears could be so stealthy. When he glanced over his shoulder, he got a bad start, for something large and brown was hurtling down toward them. Whatever it was still far away. He could only see a shape, but it was a brown shape, the very color of a bear.
"Captain, get the rifles!" he yelled in consternation. "There's a bear after us!"
For a moment the whole troop believed him. No one could clearly determine what was moving toward them, but something was, and fast. Salazar lined his men up and had them ready, their guns primed.
"I wish you'd let me shoot, Captain," Bigfoot said. "Your boys are so scared I expect half of them will miss."
"I expect it, too," Salazar said. He walked over to the nearest soldier and took his musket.
"The last time I handed a Texan a gun, he shot me," Salazar reminded him. "Please be honorable, Mr. Wallace. Shoot the bear. If we kill it, we will have meat enough to make it across the dead man's walk."
Just then Gus saw something that was even more unnerving. The bear leapt high in the air. It seemed to fly for several yards before coming back to earth. "Good Lord, it's flying," he said. As he said it, the shape flew again. The whole troop was transfixed, even Bigfoot. He had heard many bear stories, but no one had ever told him that grizzly bears could fly. He squatted and leveled his musket, though the bear, if it was a bear, was still far away. Some of the young Mexican soldiers became so nervous that they began firing when the hurtling brown object was still 200 yards away. Salazar was irritated. The wind whirled dust from the plain high so that it was hard to see anything clearly.
"Don't fire until I say fire," he said. "If you all fire now, you will be out of bullets when the bear gets here, and he will eat us all."
"I'm saving my bullet," Bigfoot said. "I intend to shoot him right between the eyes. That's the only sure way to stop a bear."
Just then, the hurtling brown object collided with a hump of rocks and flew high in the air above the dust. For the first time, Bigfoot saw it clearly, and he immediately lowered his rifle.
"Boys, old Gomez has got us rattled," he said. "That ain't a bear. That's a tumbleweed."
Salazar looked disgusted.
"7 of you shot, and the tumbleweed is still coming," he said.
"Why, it's the size of a house," Gus said.
He had never imagined a weed could grow so big. It hurtled by the company, rolling over and over as fast as a man could run. From time to time it hit a bump or a small rock and sailed into the air. Soon it was 100 yards to the south, and then it vanished, obscured by the blowing dust.
"Let us talk no more of bears," Salazar said, looking at Gus.
They marched late into the night, with only a few bites of food. In San Saba, the men had been given gourds to use as water carriers. Some of them had already drunk the last of their water, while others still had a little. The temperature had dropped, and all the men longed for a fire, but there was nothing to burn except the branches of a few thin bushes. The Texans gathered enough sticks to make a small blaze and were about to light it when Salazar stopped them.
"No fires tonight," he said.
"Why not?" Gus asked. "I'd like to warm my toes."
"Gomez will see it if he is still following us," Salazar said.
"Why would he follow us? He's done got our donkeys and most of our food," Bigfoot asked.
"He might follow us to kill us," Salazar replied.
"He could have killed you last night and he didn't," Bigfoot said. Why would he walk another day just to do what he could already have done?
Because he is an Apache, senor, Salazar said. He is not like us. He may have gone home. I don't know, but I want no fires tonight.
By midnight, the cold had become so intense that the men were forced to huddle together for warmth. Even huddled, they were so cold that several of them ceased to be able to feel their feet. Johnny Carthage could not overcome his dread. He tried to think of the sunlight of South Texas, but all he could think of was the terrible white sleet that had nearly taken his life a few days before. He was squeezed up against Long Bill. He could feel his friend shivering. Long Bill shivered violently, but slept, his mouth open, his breath a cloud of white in the cold night. Johnny began to wish that Bill would wake up. Bill had been his pard, his compañero. Bill had risked his life to locate him and bring him out of the terrible sleet storm. Now the dread of the cold was overwhelming him. He wanted Long Bill to sense it and wake up, to talk him out of what he meant to do with the small knife he'd just taken out of his pocket. He wanted his oldest and best friend to help him through the night. Johnny Carthage began to tremble even more violently than the man he was huddled against. He trembled so that he could scarcely hold the knife or raise the blade. He didn't want to drop the knife. If he did, he might not have the strength to find it in the freezing night. He didn't want to wake his friend, so tired from the long day's march, yet he needed his help, and began to cry quietly in despair. He didn't want to live. His hope was broken. No more did he want to die without his friend to help him. There was no sound on all the plain except the breathing of the exhausted men around him. The darkness was spotted with little clouds, the white breath of his compañeros. Johnny's gimpy leg was aching terribly from the cold. His foot twitched, twitched, twitched. Though he could not feel his foot, he felt twitching regular as the ticking of a clock. "Turn this leg," he whispered. "Turn this leg." Then he opened the knife and put the blade against his throat. But the blade was so cold that he withdrew it. He began to sob at the knowledge that he hadn't the strength to push the cold knife blade into his throat and cut. It meant he would freeze, but he could not do it amid the rangers because they would insist on making him go on. They would not accept the fact that he didn't want to live anymore. Johnny put the knife to his throat again, but again he withdrew it. The tip made a tiny cut in his neck, and the cold seared the cut like a brand. Johnny quietly moved an inch away from Long Bill and another. Slowly waking no one, he eased out from the midst of the rangers a foot at a time. Even when he had slipped beyond the sound of their breathing, he merely scooted over the cold ground, a foot at a time. Of all the Texans, only Matilda Roberts was awake. At night she had taken to sleeping between the two boys, making Carl turn his torn back to her so she could warm it. Gus slept on the other side, squeezed up against her as close as he could get. Both boys slept, but Matilda didn't. She saw Johnny Carthage. He crawled right by her. As he was about to go into the night, he felt her gaze and turned to look at her for a moment. He could only see her outline, not her face, nor could she see him clearly, yet she knew who he was and where he was going. Johnny paused in his crawl. The two of them looked at one another through the darkness. Matilda opened her mouth, but closed it again without speaking. Johnny Carthage was beyond her words, but she did reach out and squeeze his arm. She heard him sob. He touched her arm for a moment before he crawled away. "Oh, Johnny," she whispered, but she didn't try to stop him. Since Shadrach's death, she had used her strength for the boys, Gus and Carl. One was hurt and the other was foolish. It would take all her strength and perhaps more than her strength to get them across the desert. She could not save them and Johnny Carthage, too. Nor could Long Bill save his friend without losing his own chance to live. If the cold didn't take Johnny, the stony ground would grind at him until it broke him. If he wanted to make his own end, she felt it was wrong to stop him. His chances were slight, at best. There was no point in his suffering beyond his strength. Even so, it was hard to listen to the scraping of his poor leg as he dragged himself over the hard ground into the icy night. But the scraping grew faint, and then very faint. Soon she could hear nothing but the breathing of the two boys who slept beside her. Since the day when Caleb Cobb had struck his foot with a rifle barrel, Carl had limped almost as badly as Johnny.
Probably there were broken bones somewhere in his foot, but he was young. The broken bones would heal.
Johnny Carthage crawled on until he figured he was almost 200 yards from camp. He had worn one of his pants legs through and scraped one of his knees on the icy ground. Bigfoot had once told him that freezing men felt a warmth come over them near the end. When he judged that he was far enough from camp not to be found, even if Long Bill should wake and miss him and come looking, he stopped and sat, shivering violently. He waited for the warmth in which he could sleep and die. He had been cold long enough. He was ready for the warmth. But the warmth didn't come. Only a deeper cold, a cold that seeped inside him and chilled his lungs, his liver, even his heart. Desperate for the warmth, he opened his little knife again and clutched it tightly, meaning to plunge it into his neck where the great vein was. But before he could grasp the knife tightly enough in his shivering hands, he looked up and saw a shadow between himself and the starlight. Someone was there, a presence he felt but could not see. Before he could think more about it, Gomez struck. Johnny Carthage finally felt the longed-for warmth, a warm flood flowing down his chest onto his freezing hands. For a moment, he was grateful. Whoever was there, between him and the cold stars, had taken a hard task off his hands. Then he slipped down and the shadow was bestride him, opening his pants. Before Gomez struck again, one-eyed Johnny Carthage ceased to mind the cold or feel the pain of the knife that had severed his privates. "Old Bill," he thought. Then all thought ceased. Gomez wiped his knife on Johnny Carthage's pants leg and moved quietly toward the Mexican camp. Long before he got there, he heard the snores of several sleeping men. He had planned to kill the shivering Mexican sentries and take their guns, but when he realized the large woman was awake, he changed his mind. He did not want the large woman to know he was there. The night before, in the little cave where he rested, he had seen a snake, though it was much too cold for snakes to be moving about. Worse, late in the night, he had heard the call of an owl, though he was far out on the Malpai, where no owls flew. He knew it must be the large woman who summoned the snake and the old owl to places where they should never be. He knew the large woman must be a witch, for only a witch would be traveling through the Malpai with so many men. Gomez knew that the large woman had been the woman of Tail of the Bear, and Tail of the Bear had been a great man, perhaps a shaman. Gomez turned away from the camp at once. He did not want the witch to find out he was near. If she knew, she might summon the owl again, the boo-oo, and to hear the call of the boo-oo twice meant death. Gomez skirted the camp and walked several miles to where he left his two sons. One of them had found a wolf den that day. They had made a little fire and were cooking the wolf pups they had caught. Gomez wanted to eat one of the young wolves. He would give him cunning and protect him from the boo-oo and the witch, the large woman who had traveled with Tail of the Bear. Long Bill Coleman was frantic when he discovered that Johnny Carthage had left him in the night. He felt guilty for not having watched his friend more closely. "I expect he just went for a walk to keep warm," he said. "I ought to have kept him warmer, but it was hard without no fire." Bigfoot did not suppose that Johnny Carthage had merely walked into the night to keep his feet warm, nor did Captain Salazar believe it. A few hundred yards to the east, they saw four buzzards circling. "Bill, he went off to die. Got tired of the shivering," Matilda said, before Gus or anyone could comment on the buzzards. It was colder that day than it had been the day before. The whole troop was shivering. Salazar allowed the Texans to burn their few pitiful sticks, but the blaze was not even sufficient to boil coffee. It died, and the only warmth they had was the warmth of their own breath. They all stood around blowing on their hands. When Long Bill saw the buzzards and realized what they meant, he had to be restrained from running to bury his friend. "Bill, the buzzards have been at him," Bigfoot said. "Anyway, we got nothing to bury him with. Gus and me will go and take a look just to be sure it wasn't some varmint that froze to death." "Yes, go look," Salazar said. "But hurry, we can't wait." When Gus saw the torn white body of Johnny Carthage, he immediately turned his back. Bigfoot, though, shooed the buzzards away and took a closer look. What he saw didn't please him.
Johnny's throat had been slashed and his privates cut off. The buzzards hadn't cut his throat, nor had they castrated him. Bigfoot circled the body, hoping to see a man track, something that would allow him to gauge the strength of their opponents. If several Apaches had been there, that would be one thing. It would mean that none of them could sleep safe until they moved beyond the Apache country. But if Gomez was so confident that he would come to the camp alone, take a horse, kill a man, or several men, then they were up against someone as formidable as Buffalo Hump, someone they probably could not beat. As Gus stood with his back turned, trying to keep his heaving stomach under control, Bigfoot remembered the dream he had had back on the Pecos. The dream in which Buffalo Hump and Gomez were riding together to make war on anyone in their path, Mexican or white. Now, in a way, that dream had come true, even though the two Indians might be hundreds of miles apart and might never have met. Buffalo Hump had almost killed them on the prairie, and now Gomez was cutting them down in the New Mexican desert. If the two men, Comanche and Apache, ever did join forces, the little troop standing around in the cold would have no chance. Texans and Mexicans alike would be drained of blood like poor one-eyed Johnny Carthage, their throats cut and their balls thrown to the varmints. He looked across the long barren plain, hoping to see some sign, a wolf, a bird, a fleeing antelope, anything at all that would tell him where the Apaches were. But the plain was completely empty. Only the gray clouds moved at all. Gus McCrae had dropped to his knees. Despite himself, his stomach turned over. He retched and retched and retched. Bigfoot waited for him to finish and then led him back to camp. He didn't tell Gus what he knew or what he feared. The troop was close to panic anyway, panic and despair from the cold and hunger and the knowledge that they were on a journey that many of them would not live to finish. "Did he freeze?" Long Bill asked, grief-stricken, when Bigfoot came back. "Well, he's froze now, yes," Bigfoot said. "We should get to walking." Carl's hurt feet were paining him more even than they had been. He had wobbled the day before coming over a ridge. He hit his foot on a rock, and since then had had a sharp pain in his right foot as if a bone thin as a needle was poking him every time he put his foot down. All that day he struggled to keep up, helped by Matilda and Gus. He noticed that Bigfoot kept looking back, turning every few minutes to survey the desert behind them. It became so noticeable that Carl finally asked Gus about it. "Did Johnny just freeze?" he asked. "I don't know," Gus said. "All I seen was his body. The buzzards had been at him." "I know the buzzards had been at him, but were the buzzards all that had been at him?" Carl asked. "He means did an Indian kill him?" Matilda asked. She too had noticed Bigfoot's nervousness. Gus had not even thought about Indians. He supposed that Johnny had just gone off to walk himself warm, but had failed at it and frozen. He had only glimpsed the body from a distance. It was blood-splotched, like the body of Josh Korn had been, but he had supposed the buzzards had accounted for the blood. Now, though, once he tried to recall what he had seen, he wasn't sure. The thought that an Indian had found Johnny and killed him was too disturbing to consider. "I expect he just died," Gus said. The answer didn't satisfy Carl. Johnny Carthage had survived several bitter nights. Why would he suddenly die on a night that was no colder than the others? But Carl saw that Gus was going to be of no help. Gus didn't like to look at dead bodies. He could not be relied on to report accurately. Bigfoot was tempted to tell Captain Salazar what had happened to Johnny Carthage. He had a hard time keeping secrets. The day was bitter cold. The Texans were still bound at the wrists, and their hands began to freeze from lack of circulation. As dusk came, Bigfoot felt his anger rising. Very likely they were going to die on the dead man's walk. He reflected ruefully that the sandy stretch of country was accurately named. Why tie the hands of men who were all but dead anyway? His anger rose, and he strode up to Salazar and fell in beside him. "Captain, Johnny Carthage didn't freeze to death," he said. "He was killed." Salazar was almost at the end of his strength. The pace he set was not a military pace, but the pace of a man unused to walking. His family had a small hacienda. All his life he had ridden. Without his horse, he felt weak. Also, he liked to eat. The cold, the wound on his neck, and the lack of food had weakened him. Now, just as they faced another day with little food and another night without fire,
the big Texan came to him with unwelcome news. "How was he killed?" he asked.
"Throat cut," Bigfoot said. "He was castrated, too, but I expect he was past feeling when that happened."
"Why did you wait so long to tell me this, Señor Wallace?" Salazar asked. He kept walking slowly. He had not looked at Bigfoot.
"Because this whole bunch is about to give up," Bigfoot said.
"They'll panic and start deserting. Whoever killed Johnny will pick them off one by one."
"Gomez," Captain Salazar said. "He's toying with us."
"Untie us, Captain," Bigfoot said. "Our hands will freeze this way. We'll fight with you against the Apache, but we can't fight if our hands are frozen off. I couldn't hold a rifle steady now. My hands are too cold."
Salazar looked back at the stumbling Texans. They were weak and cold, but they still looked stronger than his own men. He knew that Bigfoot Wallace was right. His men wouldn't go much farther unless they found food. They would flee toward the mountains or else simply sit down and die. Gomez was the wolf who would finish them in his own way. He knew that if he freed the Texans and they saw a chance, they would overpower his men, kill them, or else take their guns and leave them to their fate. To free them was to accept a large risk. Yet at least, if it came to battle, the Texans would shoot. They wouldn't cut and run.
"No white man has ever seen Gomez," he told Bigfoot. "No Mexican either. We caught his wife and killed her. We have killed two of his sons. But Gomez, we have never seen. He cut my rope not a yard from my head, and yet I have never seen him."
"I don't want to see the fellow," Bigfoot said. "If I can just avoid him, I'll be better off."
"Any Apache can be Gomez," Salazar said. "He might be dead. His sons might be killing for him now. We only killed two, and he has many. It is hard to fight a man you never see."
"I've seen him," Bigfoot said.
Salazar was startled.
"You've seen him?" he asked.
"I dreamed him," Bigfoot said. "We was on the Rio Grande, trying to lay out the road to El Paso. I was with Major Chevalier. He's dead now. In my dream, I seen Gomez and Buffalo Hump riding together. They were going to attack Chihuahua City and make all your people slaves, the ones they didn't kill."
Salazar kept walking.
"I'm glad it was only in Chihuahua City," he said.
"Why?" Bigfoot asked.
"Because I don't live in Chihuahua City," Salazar said. "If they'd tried to take Santa Fe, they would have done better than you Texans did."
"I expect so," Bigfoot said.
"Will you untie us, Captain? We won't fight you. We might help save you."
"Why is this land without wood?" Salazar asked. "If we had wood and could make fires and be warm, we might survive."
"Just untie us, Captain," Bigfoot said. "We wouldn't be killing these boys of yours. Most of them ain't but half grown. We don't kill pups."
Salazar walked back through the Texans. He saw that they were suffering much from their bound hands.
"Untie them," he told his men. "But be careful. I want the best marksmen to stand guard at night and to flank these men during the day. Shoot them if they try to flee."
That night again there was no fire. All day they had looked for wood without seeing even a stick. Six riflemen guarded the Texans with their muskets ready.
Late in the night, while Texans and Mexicans alike shivered in their sleep, two of the guards walked off a little ways to piss. In the morning, their bodies, cut as Johnny Carthage's had been cut, were found less than 50 yards from camp. This time there was no hiding the truth from Gus McCrae or anyone.
"He's stalking us," Bigfoot said. "Ain't that right, Captain?"
"It is time to march," Salazar said.
For 3 days, Call could not put his right foot to the ground. Matilda and Gus took turns supporting him, alternating throughout the day. On the second day, the whole company, Mexicans and Texans alike, were so weak they were barely able to stumble along. They made less than 10 miles.
"If we can't make no better time than this, we might as well sit down and die," Bigfoot said.
He himself could have made better time than that, but he did not want to desert his companions. Not yet. Not until he had to save himself. In the afternoon of the second day, Jimmy Tweed, the gangly boy, gave up. He had turned his ankle the day before crossing a shallow gully. Now the ankle was so swollen that he could scarcely put his foot to the ground. Salazar saw Jimmy Tweed sink down and went over to him at once. He knew that the whole troop was ready to do what Jimmy Tweed had just done, sit down and wait to die. It was an option he could not allow his men, or the Texans, who, though no longer tied, were his captives. If the Texans began to give up, his own men might follow suit, and soon the whole party would be lost.
"Get up, senor," Salazar said. "We will make camp soon. You can rest your ankle then."
"Nope. I'm staying, Captain," Jimmy Tweed said. "I'd just as soon stop here as a mile or two from here."
"Senor, I cannot permit it," Salazar said. "We would all like to stop, but you are a prisoner under guard, and I make the decisions about where we stop."
Jimmy Tweed just smiled. His lips were blue from the cold. He stared through Salazar as if the man were not there. Salazar saw that all his soldiers were watching him. Jimmy Tweed made no effort to stand up and walk. Most of the Texans were some ways ahead. They were not paying attention. Each man had his own problems. None had noticed that Jimmy Tweed had stopped. Wearily, Salazar drew his pistol and cocked it.
"Senor, I will ask you courteously to get up and walk a little farther," he said. "I would rather not shoot you, but I will shoot you if you do not obey me."
Jimmy Tweed looked at him. For a moment he seemed to consider obeying the order. He put his hands on the ground as if he meant to push himself up, but after a moment he ceased all effort.
"Too tired, Captain," he said. "I reckon I'm just too tired."
"I see," Salazar said. He walked around behind Jimmy and shot him in the head. At the shot, all the Texans turned. Jimmy Tweed had pitched forward on his face, dead. Salazar walked quickly back to where the group waited, staring at the dead body of their comrade, Jimmy Tweed.
"His sufferings are over, senores," Salazar said, the pistol still in his hand. "Let's march."
The Mexican soldiers made a show of raising their guns in case the Texans chose to revolt, but in fact, none revolted. Bigfoot colored as if he were about to be seized with one of his great fits of rage, but he held himself in check. Several of the other Texans looked back at the body, sprawled on the dull sand, but in the main they were too numb to care. Several, whose feet were frozen stumps, felt a moment of envy, mixed with sadness. It was hard to dispute Captain Salazar's words. Jimmy's sufferings were over. Theirs were not.
"That's two of us that ain't been buried proper," Blackie Slidell said. "I've always supposed I'd be buried proper, but maybe I won't. There's no time for funerals out here on the Baldies."
"Proper. They weren't buried at all," Bigfoot said. "Johnny and Jimmy both got left to the varmints." Gus had the conviction that they were all going to die. As far as he could see, ahead, behind, or to the side, there was nothing. Just sky and sand. The dead man's walk was a hell of emptiness. His lips were blue from the cold and his tongue swollen from thirst. Woodrow Call groaned whenever his broken foot touched the ground. Even Matilda Roberts, the strongest spirit in the troop except for Bigfoot, merely trudged along silently. She had not spoken all day. Matilda had not looked back when Jimmy Tweed was shot. She didn't want to think about Jimmy Tweed, a boy who had been sweet to her on more than one occasion, bringing her coffee from the campfire, helping her saddle Tom when she still had Tom. Once he had asked her for her favors, but she had bound herself to Shadrach by then and had turned him down. He pouted like a little boy at being refused, but got over it in an hour and continued to do her little favors. Now she regretted rebuffing him. Shadrach had been asleep and would never have known. Sweet boys rarely knew how little time they had. Now Jimmy's had run out. Matilda put one foot in front of the other, helped call as much as she could, and trudged on. That night Blackie Slidell and six of his chums disappeared. Blackie was of the opinion that there were villages to the west. Often he pointed to columns of smoke that no one else could see.
"It's chimney smoke," Blackie said several times. He was hoping to get the company to swing west.
"It ain't chimney smoke. It ain't no smoke at all. It's just you hoping," Bigfoot said. "Gus McCrae has better eyesight than you, and he can't see no smoke over in that direction."
"It might be a piece of cloud," Gus said.
He liked Blackie and didn't want to flatly contradict him if he could help it.
Blackie saw that he wasn't going to be able to convince Bigfoot or Salazar that there were villages to the west, but he had become friendly with six boys from Arkansas, and he had better luck with them.
"Hell, I'd like to eat one more catfish from the old Arkansas River,"
one of them, a thin youth named Cotton Lovett, said.
or maybe one more possum, Blackie said. He had been down the Arkansas on occasion and remembered that the possums there were fat and easy to catch. The meat of the Arkansas possums was a trifle greasy. Several of the Arkansas boys agreed to that, but they were all so hungry that the prospect of grease only made the venture more attractive. That night, worried about Gomez, Salazar put all his men in a tight circle facing out, their guns ready. They had crossed a flat lake that afternoon, mainly dry, but with just enough smelly puddles to allow the men enough water to boil coffee. Several of the men were already cramping from the effects of bad water. The Texans had drunk, too, and were suffering. Blackie Slidell tried to interest several other men in escaping. He was sure the villages were there, but he found no takers and slipped off about midnight with the six boys. Call and Gus watched them go. For a moment, Gus felt inclined to go with them, but Call talked him out of it. "We don't know much about this country, but we do know the Apaches are that way," Call reminded him. "That's one good reason to stay with the troop."
"I would strike out with the boys, but I'm too cold," Gus said. "Anyway, I have to get you home. Clara will think poorly of me if I don't."
Call didn't answer, but he was surprised. Not by his friend's loyalty, but that, cold, hungry, lost, and a prisoner, he was still hoping to gain the good opinion of a girl in a general store in Austin. He started to point out what seemed obvious, that the girl had probably forgotten them both by this time. For all they knew, she could have married. Gus's hopes of winning her were as far-fetched as Blackie Slidell's hopes of finding a friendly village somewhere to the west. He didn't say that, though. Recent experience had shown him that men had to use what hope they could muster to stay alive. They sat together through the night, one on either side of Matilda Roberts. For several days the weather had been overcast, but when the dawn came it was clear. Just seeing the bright sunlight made them feel better, although it was still cold and the prospects still bleak. Captain Salazar had taken a little of the bad water the day before. He arose so tired and weak that he could scarcely walk to the campfire. When a cramp took him, he had to bend almost double to endure the pain. Bad as he was, his troop was worse. Several of his soldiers were too weak to rise. The fact that seven prisoners had escaped the night before didn't interest them, nor did it interest Salazar.
"Their freedom will be temporary," he told Bigfoot.
"How about our freedom, Captain?" Bigfoot asked. "Half your men are dying and half of ours, too. What's the point of keeping us prisoners when we're all dying? Why can't you just turn us all loose and let it be every man for himself? Maybe one or two of us will make it home if we do it that way."
Call and Gus were there, and Long Bill. Captain Salazar could barely stand on his feet. Even a march of 1 mile might be beyond him, and they had far more than a mile to go. Bigfoot's request seemed reasonable to them. If they were let go, they might wander off in twos and threes and find food of some sort and live, whereas if the whole troop had to stay together, they would probably all starve. Salazar looked at his troops, many of them unable to rise. He still had at most 8 soldiers who could be considered able-bodied men. The Texans had more, but not many more. The end of the dead man's walk was not in sight. It might be 3 days away, or 4, or even 5. He thought for a moment before answering Bigfoot's request. He took his pistol out of his holster, checked to see that it was fully loaded, and handed it butt first to Bigfoot Wallace. "If you want to be free, kill me," he said. Bigfoot looked at the sick, exhausted man in astonishment.
"Captain, I must have misheard," he said.
"No, you heard correctly," Salazar said. "I have decided that you can be free, if freedom is what you want most. But I am a Mexican officer, under orders to take you to El Paso. There is no one here to countermand my orders, and the general who gave them to me is dead. You saw what the Apaches did to him."
"Well, Captain, I know that," Bigfoot said. "But if the general was here and saw how weak we all are, he might change his mind."
"He might, but we cannot summon him up from hell and ask him," Salazar said. "My orders are still my orders. I cannot free you, but I will allow you the opportunity to free yourselves. All you have to do is shoot me."
Bigfoot held the gun awkwardly, not sure what to make of the captain's odd decision. He looked at Carl, at Gus, at Long Bill Coleman, and at Matilda Roberts. Now and then, throughout their time as prisoners, any one of them would have been happy to have the opportunity to kill Captain Salazar.
When Carl was being whipped, when they were chained, when Jimmy Tweed was shot,
At such moments any of them might have killed him. But Salazar was no longer the cold captain who chained them or tied them at his whim. He had suffered the same cold and the same hunger as they had, drunk the same bad water, and been weakened by the same cramps. He was a weakened man, so weakened that he had calmly ordered his own death. "Captain, I don't want to shoot you," Bigfoot said. "At times I could have done it easy, I expect, but now you're worse off than we are. I've got no stomach for shooting you now." Salazar stood his ground. He looked the Texans over. "If not you, then another," he offered. "Perhaps Corporal Call would shoot me. He endured the lash, and life has not been easy for him since. Surely he would like revenge. His feet are giving him pain, and yet I have kept him walking. Give him the gun."
"Caleb Cobb broke my feet," Call said. "You didn't. I'd shoot you if this was a fight, but I ain't going to just take your damn gun and shoot you down."
"Corporal McCray," Salazar said. "Surely you hate me enough to shoot me," Salazar said with a small smile.
"I used to, Captain, but I'm too cold and too tired to worry about shooting anybody," Gus said. "I'd just like to go home and get married quick."
Call was annoyed that once again the subject of marriage had come up, and at a time when a man's life was in the balance.
They had no prospect of even getting home. Why was he so convinced a girl would marry him, even if they did?
Salazar took his pistol and walked over to Matilda Roberts. He held the gun out to her.
"Kill me, senorita," he said. "Then you will all be free."
"Free to what?" Matilda asked. "It ain't you I need to be freed of. I ain't a prisoner anyway. What I'd like to be free of is this damn desert, and shooting you won't accomplish that."
"Then shoot me just for vengeance," Salazar said. "Shoot me to avenge your dead."
"I won't. They all died from foolishness," Matilda said. "All except my Shad. My Shad died from being in the wrong spot at the wrong time. Shooting you won't bring him back, or make me miss him no less."
Captain Salazar took the pistol and put it back in its holster.
"Caleb Cobb would have shot you if he was here," Bigfoot said almost apologetically.
He thought it bold of Salazar to take the risk he had just taken. Any Texan in the right mood might have shot him. Of course, the captain was as tired and hungry as the rest of them. His neck wound had never healed properly. There was pus on his collar. Perhaps he felt his end was coming and wanted to hasten it. Still, it was bold. A man could perhaps and perhaps all day not find his way to the truth.
"Yes, no doubt, he did shoot me," Salazar said. "But in that, too, he failed."
Then he gingerly felt his neck. He looked with a grimace at the stain on his hand.
"Perhaps I am wrong," he said. "Perhaps he didn't fail. Perhaps he merely wanted me to walk 200 hard miles before I died."
"He was blind at the time, Captain," Bigfoot said. "He just made a lucky shot. I expect he would have been happy to kill you where you stood."
Captain Salazar sighed. He looked for a moment at his weary troops.
"All right," he said. "Unfortunately, you did not accept my terms, so you're still my prisoners. If you had killed me, I would have been a martyr. Now I will only be disgraced."
"Not in my eyes. Not if you're talking about military work," Bigfoot said. "You done your best, and you're still doing it. You took on a hard job. I doubt Caleb Cobb would have even got us this far."
"I agree with that," Salazar said. "I have done my best, and Colonel Cobb would not have got you this far. He would have left to banquet with the generals and perhaps seduce their wives."
He gestured for his soldiers to get up. Two or three merely stared at him, but most of them began to struggle to their feet.
"Unfortunately, you are not a Mexican officer, Señor Wallace," Salazar said. "You are not one of the men who will judge me. I lost most of my men and many of my prisoners. That is what the generals will notice when I deliver you to El Paso. Where are the rest?" they will ask.
"Captain, I've got some advice," Bigfoot said. "Let's get to El Paso and then worry about the generals."
Salazar smiled.
"It's time to march," he said.
Toward noon that day, as the company, strung out for almost 2 miles, struggled south, they came upon 3 dead cows, starved within a mile of one another. The buzzards were on the carcasses, but they hadn't been on them long. All the carcasses were stiff from the night's frost. Although all 3 cows were mostly just skin and bones, to the weary troop at the point of starvation itself, their discovery seemed like a miracle.
The men who lagged soon caught up. All the men were soon tearing at the thin carcasses with their knives, trying to scrape a few bits of meat off the cold bones. Captain Salazar only with difficulty restored order. He fired his pistol twice to get the hungry men to back off. While they were making a fire and preparing to roast the bones and what little flesh remained, Bigfoot saw several specks rise into the air from far to the south. "I think them was ducks," he said. "If there's ducks, there must be water. We can have us a fine soup, if that's the case."
"Well, we got the soup bones, at least," Gus said.
He ran south with Bigfoot and sure enough found a creek, mostly dry but with several small scattered pools of water. The troop camped for 2 days, until every bone of the three animals had been boiled for soup. Most of the bones were then split for their marrow. The food was welcome, and also the rest. Through the 2 days and nights, the prairie scavengers, who had been deprived of their chances at the carcasses, prowled around the camp. Coyotes and wolves stood watching during the day. Two ventured too close, a coyote and a wolf. Bigfoot shot them both and added their meat to the soup.
"I don't know about eating wolf," Gus said. "A wolf will eat anything. This one might have poison in its belly. You don't know."
"Don't eat it, then, if you're scared," Bigfoot said. "There'll be more for the rest of us."
Call ate the wolf and coyote soup without protest. His bad foot, though still painful, was better for the rest. Near the little creek there were some dead trees. Matilda chopped off a limb with a fork in it and made Call a rude crutch. She knew how much he hated having to be helped along by her and by Gus. He accepted it because his only other option was death, but he accepted it stiffly. The look in his eyes was the look of a man whose pride was wounded. "I thank you," he said in a formal tone when she presented him with the rude crutch. But the look in his eyes was not formal. It was a look of gratitude. Gus saw how fond Matty had become of Call, despite his rudeness. He felt very jealous. He himself had been cheerful and friendly, and had courted Matty as much as she would allow, and yet, since the death of Shadrach, she had fastened her attentions on his surly friend. It annoyed him so much that he mentioned it to Bigfoot. Call and Matty were sitting together eating soup. Neither Call nor Matilda was saying anything, but still, they sat together, sipping wolf soup that a young Mexican soldier had just dished out of the pot.
"Now what's the point of spending all that time with Call?" Gus asked. "Call don't care for women. It's rare that I could get him to go with a whore."
Bigfoot studied the couple for a minute, the large woman and the short youth.
"Maddie's got her motherly side," he said. "Most cows will take a calf if one comes up that needs her."
"Well, I need her, I guess,"
Gus said. Now that his belly didn't growl quite so loudly, his envy had returned.
"I'm as much a calf as he is. We're the same age," Gus said.
"Yeah, but you're easy to get along with, and Woodrow ain't," Bigfoot said.
"Well, then she ought to be sitting with me, not with that hard-headed fool," Gus said. "He ain't saying a word to her. I can out-talk him any day."
"Maybe it ain't talk she's after," Bigfoot suggested.
Long Bill Coleman had been stretched out on the ground, resting on his elbow as he listened to the little debate.
"Why are you griping, Gussie?" he asked. "She ain't sitting with me either, but you don't hear me complaining."
"Shut up, Bill. What do you know about women?" Gus asked testily.
"Well, I know they don't always cotton to the easy fellows," Long Bill said. "If they did, I'd have been married long ago. But I ain't married, and it's going to be another cold night."
"Why, he's right," Bigfoot said. "Matty likes Woodrow because he's hard-headed."
"Oh, I suppose you two know everything," Gus said.
He went over to where the two sat and plopped himself down on the other side of Matilda.
"Matty and her boys," Bigfoot said, smiling at Long Bill. "I doubt she expected to be the mother of two pups when she headed west with his outfit."
Long Bill wished the subject of mothers had never come up. His own had died of a fever when he was 10. He had missed her ever since.
"If Ma was alive, I expect I would have stayed with farmin'," he said, with a mournful look. "She cooked cobbler for us when she was well. I ain't ate cobbler since it was half as good."
"I hope this starvin' is over," Bigfoot said. "I don't want to think about cobbler or taters until we get back to where folks eat regular."
The carcasses had been consumed completely. When the troop left on the morning of the third day, they had no food at all. They were cheerful, though. The fact that they had seen ducks convinced many of the men that they were almost out of the desert. The Texans began to talk of catfish and venison, pig meat and chickens, as if they would be sitting down to lavish meals within the next few days. Salazar listened to the talk with a grim expression.
"Señores, this is still the dead man's walk," he said. "We have far to go before we come to Las Cruces.